Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I am Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. Our speaker today, Rafiq Dosani, is a senior research scholar at the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center, Stanford University. His research areas include development, education, finance, international relations, outsourcing, and telecommunications. Prior to joining Stanford, he was the CEO of Jardine Fleming India, an investment bank. He has also served as deputy editor of Business India magazine. Dr. Dosani is the author of several books about South Asia and India, including Does South Asia Exist?, available here tonight. You'll see copies there in the back. Please welcome Rafiq Dosani to discuss the Muslims of India, their politics, identity, and economy.
Thank you, Norma, for that kind introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here. I'm not as tall as Norma is, so I'm going to come out here and speak. I hope I'm still in the line of the video. That I always tell my friends when I go back to India, it's a great pleasure to go to a movie hall with everyone sort of my height, you know, whereas here I have to sit in front. I do, at Norma's request, want to recognize one of our guests who's come. Mr. Tuhin is the Deputy Consul General for India. He's a good friend of mine, and it's very nice of him to come today. So India is a land of amazing diversity, as you probably will be finding out more or if you've been attending sessions on India. An example is that if you look at newspapers, for example, so the US has about 1,500 newspapers, China has about 2,000. India, because there's so many languages, has about 45,000 newspapers. Every day, the government-owned radio station broadcasts in over 300 different dialects stroke languages. So that gives you a sense of the diversity. It's also a vibrant democracy. That's probably well known. What's not as well known is how long-standing a democracy it is. People often date India's democracy to 1947. But if you look at how far back free elections were held with limited mandates and power, so under British rule, actually that goes back to 1885. So there's been an experience with organizing for democracy for a much longer time. So in that context, this topic. So why is this an interesting topic? The Muslims of India. So this is a wordy slide, so bear with me as I walk you through it. So I mentioned already the first bullet that India has a long experience with democracy. And it's often argued that democracy acts as a force to stabilize populations. And in the context of the big turmoil over Islam ever since 9/11 or even earlier, this has been a subject of particular interest. So it's been argued, for example, states like Pakistan, which have moved in and out of democracy since independence in 1947, are much more vulnerable, simply because they have populations that have not experienced the stabilizing influence of democracy. So if that is the case, then, you know, one of the sub-bullets you see there is an argument I make, that if the problem is with Islam rather than with democracy, then radicalism among Muslims ought to be particularly acute among minority populations. In India, about 13% of the population is Muslim, And so what we see is the absence of radicalism among Muslims of India. And people have widely commented on this, including Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, who says, see, look at the Muslims of India. They're an example of a population that is not radicalized because India is a democracy. So does the absence of radicalism among Muslim Indians tell us anything about Indian democracy? So that's one of the interesting questions I want to explore in some more depth. I note here that it's an interesting problem because it's a large population. We're not talking of a minuscule group that might be marginalized, and therefore what they did would not be noticed within a larger polity. What you see is that India has 160 million Muslims, about 13% of the population, and the third largest of any state after Indonesia and Pakistan. So in terms of sort of the key question that I want to ask is, and I ask this question in the context of India as a vibrant, growing country, which has been in the news for that reason now, one that, you know, is slowly taking its place, its rightful place among the global elite, and is viewed by many countries, including the United States, as a strategic partner. Within that context, this 13%, this 160 million Muslims, how mainstreamed are they? I must say, to give you a preview of my talk, I don't end on a very positive note, okay? So I've been saying the good things so far, but be ready for some things to go rapidly downhill. So why have I taken politics, identity, and economy as my three markers? So the argument is in the literature. Mainstreaming requires all three. A citizen is mainstreamed within a democracy if he can securely assume multiple identities depending on his interests. In other words, it shouldn't just be a faith-based identity. You should say, yes, I'm a Muslim, but also I'm a woman, and therefore I'm interested in women's issues or women's issues. I'm a Muslim, but I belong to a certain non-profit group that's interested in environmental issues. So you should be able to assume multiple identities, just like we do here. You know, we take it for granted that our faith is not the only marker of identity and may often be a very minor marker of identity. So that's one. So identity is key to mainstreaming. Second is you should be able to exercise political power through representation. So it's one thing to have the vote in a free democracy like India. Another is that that vote counts in the sense that if you then, as a Muslim citizen of India, go to your elected representative, you expect certain outcomes from that. Or you expect that someone you vote for acts at least some of the time on the issues of your interest. So that's the second one. So that's the political part. And the third is the economy or the social institution, that as a citizen you should be able to freely participate in the country's social institutions, such as education, healthcare, housing, professions, and so on. So that's my sort of reason for giving you why this is an interesting topic. I'll now justify why I'm going to pick certain areas for focus. So this is a map of India, and these are the districts of India. You know, the country is divided into administrative districts, and here you see different colors. So green is the color where Muslims account for more than 25% of the population. And you see they're heavily concentrated in the north and the central part of India. This color is 10 to 25, 5 to 10, and then 1 to 5, and then less than 1 is the white. So one thing you see is that Muslims are spread out all over India. Obviously they have some greater concentration in some areas, particularly in the north and in the west, and that flows down into the south. And historically, there's a good reason for this. Mostly prior to the Mughal invasions of India, earlier dynastic invasions, Muslims came for trade. So they came from the Middle East for trade, and they settled along the western coast. And so that explains this. And then this came through successive waves of invasion. The earliest was 800 years ago, and they moved the furthest east. So actually the heaviest concentrations you also find in Bengal, and also this part that's missing, which is now Bangladesh. So for that reason, I'm going to justify this map to later on I'll be spending a lot of time on this area, which is the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is India's most populous state, one of India's poorest states as well. And as you can see, Muslims have a particularly high concentration in that state. So one of the questions I'll be asking is, how have they done in this state? By the way, as I go along, this is meant to be very interactive, very informal. If you have clarifications, questions, we don't need to wait till a question hour for your questions. Just put your hand up and we can have a chat. Okay, so if you look at what was the case at independence, so the first census was taken 4 years after India's independence, and it found that Muslims were economically at the national average. This was despite the fact that the economic status was below the average in both urban and rural areas. Is that possible or is that a mistake? Ah, so think. I'm going to give you the answer in a moment by clicking this, but anyone wants to guess why? So they were just below the average in the urban areas, much more below the average in the rural areas, but they are substantially more urban population than a rural population. That's why. So urban areas significantly better off than rural areas, and Muslims were much more present in urban than rural areas. So a largely urbanized population, or much more than the general average. So 80% was rural versus 70% for the Muslims. And the disparity, if you do the math, they actually came out just below the average. Some people often argue that the partition, the creation of Pakistan, was a reason for the Muslims being worse off. But studies have shown that that had some effect, but largely insignificant. So 1951, that was the Muslim population, sort of fairly well mainstreamed. They'd been there forever. They viewed themselves as Indian. Almost all of them still do. And, you know, they were ready to make their lives in the new country. So that was 1951. And now we come to how have they done in terms of what really matters, which if you look at their performance. So you see that if you look at, say, these are often used as measures of how a community looks after itself, because these are things where at the family level you can influence things, regardless of how you work in the mainstream. So you see here, if you look at the sex ratio, for example, the number of females per 1,000 males, it's still below the natural norm, which should be over 1,000, but Muslims are doing better than the average. If you look at the infant mortality rate, again, very high. Countries like, even poorer countries like Bangladesh are better than India, but still Muslims are doing better than the average, both in both parameters of infant mortality, the under 5 and the under 1. This I was telling about the urban ratio. Population growth is a little higher. Some of that is linked to them being more urbanized. And all the evidence suggests that if you adjust for class status and urbanization, you'd get the same population growth rate for Muslims as for the rest of the country. This I put down because this is often blamed in a sense for Muslim radicalism, is that Muslims attend madrasas. Madrasas are Muslim schools which are largely for teaching the Arabic language and the Quran, or at least how to read Arabic, but they also offer secular education. In fact, in many regions of India, even now in very poor areas, because of the secular education offered by madrasas, Muslims and non-Muslims will attend. But that's really gone down. I mean, there must have been a higher proportion at independence. But you can see the desire for mainstreaming. It's down to just 4% now. And that too would not necessarily be a full-time attendance. Okay, so you can see here a community that's... you want to know what a madrasa is? Yeah, yeah. So it's a school to teach religious... about the religion. So you can see here a community that doesn't seem to have done that badly. There are some... these parameters suggest that it's actually done quite well. But what's interesting is when you compare this with how they have done in terms of their socioeconomic status. So normally you'd expect those earlier statistics to be associated with a higher socioeconomic status, but in fact it's associated with a worse socioeconomic status. So here I provided this data in terms of three types of categories of the population. One is the Muslims, one is the India numbers, and the third column is a very interesting one from from a certain point of view, that there's a certain group in India which were identified at independence as being particularly backward, and even well before that, the untouchable caste, which was then given a certain name called the scheduled caste, so called because the constitution of India put them down in a certain schedule of the constitution. So they are scheduled castes, and those listed under that belong to the scheduled caste. And then you also have the tribals, who were also economically and socially backward, and so they were also listed in a certain schedule of the constitution, and they were called the scheduled tribes. So for them, the government organized a reservation of jobs in government service, reservation of places in schools, and so on. So a strong affirmative action program, because at independence they were firmly at the bottom of the economic ladder. And a lot of that had to do with the lack of economic power, the lack of political power, and so on. But what you see is, as of 2001, there's been a change. So where earlier they were firmly at the bottom, you can see how the Muslims and the have sort of come down to the level of the scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. So if you look at urban poverty, 38% among Muslims, 36% among the SCST. And of course, much worse than the All India average. Rural poverty, less significant a difference between the All India and Muslim average. The per capita spending, you can see again, Muslims have fallen sharply below the national average, but above the SCST. Completed high school, the Muslims are now trending down towards the SCST level, well below the All India. Population over 20 who are graduates, again you can see what's happening here. And this is interesting, in terms of political power, you can see a dramatic effect here. So they make up about 22.5% of India's population, and have roughly that, slightly more than that as a percentage in parliament. Muslims, who make up 13% of India's population, have 4% roughly as representation in parliament out of 545. So this, what this table does is bring out that what a group that was at the average has steadily fallen since. I haven't given you the changes every decade, but it's been like that. And what you see now is a community that's actually almost at the same level as the scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. In other words, those who are at the bottom of the economic ladder and the social ladder, but of course now much more powerful than them politically. So actually their rates of progress should be higher looking ahead. And that's due to significant political changes in the last several years. So what you see is a community that has fallen down. Okay, so what you saw in the earlier table was a community that was in some ways succeeded in looking after itself. But what this brings out was this was despite this immense decline in their economic status and their political power. So what are the causes? Obviously, my interest is in saying, yes, this has happened. And actually, there's hardly any debate in India on this issue. There was a report in about 5 years ago called the Sachar Committee report, which for the first time looked at these issues. It was a government committee. But even that has largely lain in the dust since, you know. There's been no informed debate at all on this important issue. And in some sense, I'm not surprised, because as you'll see, there are good reasons for the apathy. Yes. You caught me there, I'm not sure. Good question. Yeah, I need to find out more on that. Okay. My understanding is that it's probably around the same. It's always been though, yeah. Have gone up, yes. Yeah. Thanks, that was a good question. Okay, so causes. So one is, I made a case earlier that I'm going to look for good reason at identity, politics, and economics, right? So let me begin with one marker of identity, which is language. Okay, now Urdu, which is an official language of India according to the Constitution of India, is a very important language for Muslims in the north. So most of the Muslims live in the northern part of India, north and central India. For them, right from independence, their language has been Urdu. It's not been only their language. Many others speak good Urdu who are not Muslims. But for Muslims, that has been their only language. So that's why, you know, it becomes then an important marker of identity. Now, if you consider the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is, as I mentioned, was India's most populous state and very important for Muslims, 19% of UP's population. UP is Uttar Pradesh, which translated to English means the northern state. 19% of Uttar Pradesh's population is Muslim. So official discrimination, let's give you some examples. In October 1947, I mean barely a few months after independence, the UP state legislature voted to stop state schools from teaching in Urdu. It also legislated that no state business would be conducted in Urdu. So suddenly a population, roughly 20% of the population, suddenly found that the language it spoke in had some resonance because it was very similar to Hindi, but the language that it read in and wrote in, they could no longer use that. So suddenly they were just cut off from not just their cultural grounding, but their economic grounding. Now, interestingly, the result has been a move away from Urdu in Uttar Pradesh. And it's natural, right? If there's no livelihood, why would people want to learn the language? And it's going to cost them, because the state schools, which still account for the overwhelming majority of schools that Indians go to, do not teach Urdu. So you have to go to a private school, and that's costlier. So as a result, only 3% of Muslims in UP today speak Urdu as their first language. The language is taught only as a second language. It can't be taught as a first language because the school exams are not in Urdu. Because the school exams, which are, you know, statewide in India, are only in English and in Hindi. So language is only taught as a second language in a few community-funded schools. In effect, what the state has told Muslims in UP, you want to learn Urdu, create your own schools, no money for you. It's like treating them like an immigrant community within their own state. In a sense, they've ghettoized their access to Urdu language, because those are located in certain areas where Muslims are in number. So this was one of the arguments, that Urdu is the language of Pakistan. But of course the reality is it was also the language of, in fact there are far more Urdu speakers in India than in Pakistan at independence, because Pakistan was a state created out of areas that did not speak Urdu in large part, right? The Sindh, for example, only Punjab had some Urdu in it. Even today only 13% of Pakistan's population declares Urdu as its first language. 58% declares Punjabi as its first language. So that was just a device used to discriminate. Yeah. So now, interestingly, Muslim groups haven't given up. A few weeks ago, I was in Lucknow. Lucknow is the capital of Uttar Pradesh. And I met up with the head of religious communities there. So I met up with the head of the Shia community and one head of the Sunni community. As many of you may know, Islam has these two divisions. And he mentioned to us, the head of the Shia community mentioned to me, he said, you know, this is a big problem for us because we think it's part of our culture. He says, you know, we regularly submit petitions to the government to change this. We go to our elected legislators, we go to our elected corporators, we've gone to the chief minister, and he mentioned that he just a month ago submitted a petition to her to bring back Urdu as an official language. So that's what they do. And I think I'd like to point out something that's often missed. They're not going into deep violence over this. So this is a community that's really in a very peaceful way, within the democratic setup, tried to use, despite, I would say, severe provocation. I mean, it's been 60 years of no action. And yet this is what they keep on doing. In fact, the country has lost out in big time, because Urdu was and is considered the language of high culture and poetry, even more, much more than Hindi. So if you talk to someone in Bollywood, I'm not saying that Bollywood is a paragon of culture, it's not, but the language even today contains as much Urdu as it does Hindi. And that's for other reasons, nothing to do with UP, which I'll come to later. So this shows that, you know, a couple of things. One is discrimination officially. It also shows the willingness of Muslims to work within the system. And it shows the effect that today only, you know, the community, basically Urdu is dying out in Uttar Pradesh. Yes.
So, in those families where the parents speak the language,
Yes. They're not, right? Yes, yeah, okay, good question. Yeah. So the question is that among families, you know, whose parents and grandparents spoke Urdu because of the legacy, right? They knew it at the time of partition, have continued learning it since. Do the children learn in Urdu? And the answer is they do not. And maybe I was going to show a slide on this in a moment. But the reason is that there are no jobs in Urdu. You can't take your school exams in Urdu. So there's a strong disincentive to learn Urdu as an important language. You might learn it if the parents are very keen and want to preserve it as a second or a third language. So your first language will typically be English, if you can afford it and you're urban. And then your second language, in that case, would be Hindi, because that's where it would be taught in school and you'd be examined on that and so on. And then if there is some time, you might send your kid to a madrasa to learn Urdu. So that proportion has declined today from 100% to 3%. And 3%, by the way, includes all Muslims. That means among children is probably even less than that. It'd be higher among the adults. Recently, the Shia head was telling me that the state government needed to translate some old archives that of the state which were in Urdu, because prior to 1947, business was done in Urdu. Need to translate that into Hindi. And so they advertised for, I think, two positions. I said there were several thousand applicants for those two positions, all older people, because, you know, they know the language, but of course there are not enough jobs. There was a question there? Yes.
I was going to ask, you mentioned that Urdu was kind of taken out of the mainstream because of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the reason
So the reason was this feeling among those who ruled India, they ruled the state of Uttar Pradesh, and it's a complex question you're asking, but by and large, if you look at the records of the debates that happened around this October 1947 passage of this legislation, the argument was made that Urdu is a foreign language. And really it's not that different from Hindi because the grammar is so similar, it's just a flowery script that has no relevance. Which of course completely untrue, one. Secondly, it doesn't reflect the will of those who speak it, right? So let me go on to the next one, which is, isn't this against the Constitution of India, right? Article 20 guarantees the right of citizens in any part of India to preserve their distinct language, script, and culture. Article 350A, the state must provide adequate facilities for instruction in the mother tongue at the primary level for children belonging to linguistic minority groups. And this has been defined and endorsed by the HRD, the Human Resource Development Ministry, first defined by the Minorities Commission only in 2007, by the way. It is recommended to be compulsory for the authorities to include education in the mother tongue of every child, including especially Urdu and Punjabi. For instruction in the mother tongue, a minimum of 60 pupils in the last four classes over 4 years or 15 pupils in the current class is adequate. I mean, this condition is easily met in thousands and thousands of locations, in schools in Uttar Pradesh. It's an official guideline. This was always there, but they just don't do it. You know, if the state government behaves illegally, who's going to take them to task? You have to sue them. What they're doing is clearly illegal. So Muslims have preferred to, in a sense, fight within the system rather than go to court and sue the state. I just thought you might enjoy, you know, the state government just ignore. In the words of Mr. Bumble of Oliver Twist, they believe the law is an ass, an idiot. If that's the eye of the law is a bachelor. Of course, it's a completely different context. Mr. Bumble was talking about his wife. And the worst I wish the law is that his eye may be opened by experience. This is what is relevant. They're not aware of the damage that they have done in terms of the enfranchisement of Muslims in India by getting rid of their language. Does that answer your question, yeah, about the legal side?
Yeah, but I was just wondering, because there was a controversy in Pakistan, and Pakistan also was made a national language, knowing that there are multiple languages that people spoke there. But Urdu was used to create the identity of the country. So I was just wondering from that point of view, in India also.
Yes.
So
you're right. I mean, there's a certain logic there for having a common language, right, which creates an identity. And this is what Nehru tried in, Prime Minister of India tried in the 1950s. So Hindi was opposed, it was imposed as a national language. But you can't do that in a country with so many languages. So, you know, immediately there were riots all over the country. Not in Uttar Pradesh so much, but in the south, for example, where Malayalam was the language of Kerala, Tamil was the language, and people lost their lives in these demonstrations and violent rioting, and Nehru had to back down, and in fact gave up. So actually, I was going to talk about this later. The reason Urdu has survived in India actually goes back to these language agitations, which had nothing to do with Urdu. They had to do with other languages, Marathi, Malayali, Kannada, you know, the southern languages, Tamil, Telugu, and so on. The violent agitations that followed Nehru's decision to impose this one language policy led him to back down. In that process, those languages that were there in a smaller way, including Urdu in Andhra Pradesh and Urdu in Maharashtra and Urdu in Karnataka, so in other states where Muslims are there but not as in as much population, there Urdu got saved. So the irony is that in India's most populous state and the birth of Urdu is in Uttar Pradesh as a language. In that, Urdu is not taught, but in other states, Urdu is protected to an extent, in Maharashtra and so on. But of course, those are very small proportions of the total population. Question?
Yes, even more than the group, like if there are two passengers traveling in South India, maybe somewhere down there, one person speaks Hindi and one person speaks Tamil, they will communicate to each other in English.
Well, it depends whether they know English. You know, 60% of... you know, I mean, you may have your own experience of that, but we can talk about that later. I'd be interested in the source of that fact. But we can come back to that. So, yeah. So here, you know, it's the thing I was going to put up earlier. Here you see a mosque in Lucknow, I believe. And, in Lucknow. And you see, Urdu sort of disappeared in a sense. This is a current picture. By the way, the exhortation in Hindi, for those who can read it, is very interesting. It's ironic. You can read?
I could.
Go ahead, tell us what it says. Oh, you can't?
I'm okay.
Angrezi bolna sikhiye. Learn how to speak English. That's what this says. In just a few months, by the way. So, maybe they'll get green cards later. So this is you can read the poem, little poem there about Urdu. Anyone, you can, Farooq, you can read it and understand it. Tuhin, of course, would know it well. You know Urdu very well, right, Tuhin? Yes. Parke sunaiye? I'll translate it, yeah. You read it. So it goes from door to door in search of a home, because Urdu has lost its home. That's what it says. So it's an irony. So moving on. So the conclusion I make about identity is that the identity degradation now is complete. And it struck me quite forcibly when I interviewed the Minorities Commission about a month ago in Delhi. The Minorities Commission is this body which has been formed by the government. So it's a statutory body that advises the government on how to protect the rights of minorities. And it's a 6-member body. It's, each community of importance, the Parsis, the Sikhs, the Muslims, the Christians, has a representative on that committee. So a member of the minority committee told me, what are you saying? You know, I was giving him all this data that I just presented to you, and telling him, Muslims have lost their identity in India. In the sense, they've lost it in the sense, all it is now is a Muslim identity. It's not a diverse identity. It's not the identity of a citizen of India in the true sense. And he said, what are you saying? You're wrong. He says, today Muslims can hold their heads high. It is because of their strategic voting in different states that the BJP is not in the government today. So to give you a sense of context, the BJP was in the government till 2004, so it ruled in a coalition. And the BJP is widely viewed, I think correctly, as an anti-Muslim party, sort of a fascistic party for example, the Gujarat riots were under BJP rule, and so on. So he told me, you're wrong, because today Muslims have voted strategically and their vote in different states has kept the BJP out of power. They can hold their heads high in India today. They are full citizens of India. And what he said is true. You know, and I had interviewed the ex-chief minister of Andhra Pradesh, which is a very large state, 80 million people, with a substantial Muslim population. He told me he lost the election because the Muslim vote left him. Not because he himself was anti-Muslim, but because at New Delhi, he had chosen to support the BJP government. Not join it, but just support it from outside. And his interest was purely local politics. Locally, his opposition was the Congress Party, which he wanted to keep out of power in New Delhi, so he allied with the BJP. But the Muslims of Andhra Pradesh said, this is wrong, we don't agree with it, you're allying with the fascist party. So they voted against him and he lost power. Actually, this was a very important reason for the BJP's failure to come to power. The other important reason was this switch, the defection in a sense of another important supporter of the BJP, the Trinamool, which defected from supporting the BJP up to 2004 and then switching to the Congress. And they did that largely because West Bengal is 25% Muslim and they needed the Muslim votes to come into power locally. Okay, so he's right. But point is, what does it tell us about the identity of Muslim? My point, which I respond to, I said, that's exactly the point I'm trying to make. They have no other identity. They must vote according to what their religion is, not as to whether they are women or they are of a certain class, of a certain profession, live somewhere. So in that sense, this statement to me captured the point I'm trying to make, which is the identity degradation of the Muslim community is complete. Okay, the second cause, the misappropriation of community assets by the state. This is widespread. It has particularly been targeted at assets owned by Muslim trusts. So, example, in 1970, a case was filed in the Delhi court to transfer land originally owned by Muslim trusts and meant to be used for providing education, religious and other social services to the community. The land had been misappropriated by the state government. The national government, on an appeal by the trust, agreed with the Muslim trust, and it agreed to join the trust in their petition. So a petition was then filed in 1970 jointly by the trust and the national government in New Delhi. However, the national government refused to ever send a representative to the hearings. And the last hearing took place in 1984. And nothing has happened since till 2011. So the land is still with the state and they have using it as they want. So this is just one of probably hundreds of examples. If you want more detail, the Sachar Committee has much more detail in that. And behind that, there's, if you like, I can provide you with information. So misappropriating the community's assets is another strategy that the state has used. Here, gerrymandering, a time-honored tradition of any democracy. But look how perniciously it's been used in India. So here you see in the state of Uttar Pradesh, 8 reserved constituencies. So if you remember, I had mentioned the SCST, the Scheduled Castes and Tribes, given a reservation of seats. So 22.5% of the seats in state legislatures, in parliament and so on, are reserved for the Scheduled Castes and Scheduled Tribes. Of course, they can get more if they win in other constituencies. So normally what would happen is that those constituencies with a large percentage of scheduled castes and scheduled tribes would be designated as reserved constituencies. But what the UP government did right at the start in 1947 was perniciously pick those constituencies for reservation which were Muslim, which had high Muslim proportion. So suddenly Muslims found that they could never elect a Muslim to any of these, because scheduled castes and scheduled tribes pretty much are not Muslims. I mean, overwhelming, 99% plus. Whereas, where the scheduled castes were in fairly large number and could win on their own, they did not reserve them. So they were fair to the scheduled castes, but unfair to the Muslims here. So here's another example where the state government actively participated in reducing the political power of Muslims. So not just identity, but also political power. And then finally, employment discrimination. So what you see here is Muslim share of government employment, and this is an important statistic because government is the biggest employer in the organized sector in India, even today. So you see here, Uttar Pradesh, 5 versus their share of the population. West Bengal is even worse. The Marxists who rule there have much to answer. 2 versus 25, and so on. Interestingly, the only one that comes close to parity is Andhra Pradesh, and that has to do with 2 centuries of Muslim rule in Andhra Pradesh up to 1947 or 48, which has led to a great tolerance of the language. And unlike Uttar Pradesh, Urdu is an official state language in Andhra Pradesh, even though it's spoken by far fewer people than in Uttar Pradesh. And coming to the private sector, I've not spent much time on that, but it's open. The discrimination in terms of hiring, in terms of access to bank capital, housing, education, healthcare, is widespread among the private sector against Muslims. I remember when I was an analyst and headed the investment bank called Jardine Fleming that Norma referred to, I had gone to one of India's largest companies, and it's still today one of the largest, called Bajaj Auto. Anyone heard of it? Yeah, you heard of it. So they make motorcycles, and very big, successful company. And I asked them, I said, do you hire Muslims? He said, no, of course we don't. I'd heard they didn't, but as an analyst, I wanted to verify my facts. I said, why don't you hire Muslims? He said, what's wrong with that? We don't hire women either. So, you know, that's what they can get away with. So that's unfortunate, but they get away with it because the state is complicit. You know, if the state is doing it right, left, and center, the private sector that wants to do it faces no problems. And all of this ultimately leads to ghettoization. You know, the location of Muslims in areas where they're just Muslims, and they create these self-sufficient low-end economies. Coming to the final cause, you know, so it's one thing to keep on discriminating in this subtle way, you know, in terms of the laws and so on. But, you know, the state has not been shy of actually using violence to quickly bring a community to its knees. So look at the statistic. The Home Ministry, the Indian Home Ministry's count is of 800 communal clashes annually. These are invariably clashes between Muslims and Hindus. Official records show 150 dead annually from these clashes, most of whom are Muslims. Almost all such incidents involve some official support, usually the local legislator or corporator, and almost always the local police. The local police is probably the most communalized of any government group in India. In addition, the police regularly, this again is recorded in the Sachar Committee document, regularly stage fake encounters. So what they'll do is to create an anti-Muslim feeling based on some political whim. They'll round up Muslim youth from a poor area, take them to a place and shoot them. And then they will say they were gangsters trying to escape, so we found them stealing or something, and so we shot them. So this has two effects. One, it isolates the Muslim youth and the community because they know about the fake encounter. It scares them out of their wits. It ghettoizes them, so they're terrorized. But it also raises mainstream opinion against the Muslim because the newspaper dutifully report this. You know, these names, Muslims killed in an encounter with the police. Now, finally, thanks to a very good law that came in India a few years ago called the Right to Information Act and a very activist Supreme Court, and I can talk much more about that if you want, this thing is starting to change. The fake encounters are now slowly coming to light. Because in the Right to Information Act, you can actually go and get the data that was never available earlier. The most offensive in recent times was the rioting in Gujarat, in the state-sponsored pogrom, in effect, in which 2,000 Muslims were killed. The effect is that of ghettoization. So ghettoization emerges as sort of a key channel for the decline of the Muslim community. So if you look at what has happened, you know, in 1947 you had a community that was middle class, integrated with the wider society, and then this pattern of steady discrimination affecting all three key aspects of mainstreaming. And then you use riots to ghettoize. Once you ghettoize, you create these self-sufficient low-end economies that are unable to trade with the vibrant Indian economy outside. And so the income and political power continue to fall. And the result is, as of today, Urdu-speaking outside of Uttar Pradesh, low-income, disenfranchised, but a Muslim class. That is their identity. So what can be done? So here I must enter the realms of speculation. My interview is in July with the National Commission for Minorities, this body that is charged with protecting and furthering the socioeconomic status, revealed that, listen to this, two members were unaware that Urdu was not taught in state schools in UP and that it was not a recognized language for state business. One of them told me, that's appalling, we must do something about it. These are people who should know, right? Two members argued against promoting Urdu in UP on the grounds that it will unnecessarily radicalize the community, thus showing their ignorance of the constitution. One member, a Muslim, argued that the better strategy was to promote economic access. He cited recent plans by the commission to help banks introduce interest-free banking as a device. You know, you've heard of Islam promoting interest-free banking. Obviously, again, totally unaware of the reality. An official report by the Reserve Bank of India in 2001 found that Muslims did not access credit in many cases due to banks' unwillingness to set up branches in areas where they live, and that credit officers often discriminated against them. For a population that makes up 13.4% of the country, they account for 12.2% of deposit accounts. Clearly, you can see participation, right? So if you have individual accounts, and if this roughly the same proportion as the total population, it's not that they want interest-free banking. They are participating. They get only 5% of deposits and 5% of individual loans. So this is not a significant issue. And I pointed this out to the gentleman who is the chairman of the commission. But they live in their own world. So what's a Muslim to do? He's unradicalized. He participates actively in elections. Muslim voting percentages are among the highest. Increasingly disenfranchised, dreaming of an idealized past. Here you see the idealized past. So this beautiful structure I visited in Lucknow recently. An arch structure without beams or columns, 170 feet long, 60 feet wide, 50 feet high. I actually got lost over here. There's this, up here there's something called the Bhul Bhulaya. Anyone heard of that? Bhul Bhulaya is, you've heard of it? You know what it means? Oh, okay, even there. So Bhul Bhulaya means maze. Because this has no beams or columns, it's actually made of 8 interlocking domes. And that's what holds this structure up. It's not made of any stone, it's made of brick and mortar. So quite an amazing building. But because of that interlocking structure of domes and arches, they've created this maze inside, this labyrinth. There are 49 identical looking narrow doorways where you can get lost. And it's completely dark and you have to go up without your shoes and so on. So suddenly I found, I was with this friend of mine, and he was, between us we were too cheap to get a guide. So we were stuck in this maze, and I'm telling him, this is my college friend. I said, Akhtar, I have a plane to catch in a few hours. And we're lost. And you can't see anything, it's completely dark. He said, no problem, Rafiq Bhai. You know, he screamed at the top of his lungs. He said, this is now modern, populated, crowded India. He screamed at the top of his lungs, and sure enough, someone came in a few minutes and got us out. So what can be done? You know, these are just my thoughts. I'd welcome your thoughts. Create broad-based, multi-ethnic civil society groups to promote Muslim rights. To get the mainstream involved. There are, you know, India is not radicalized against Muslims by any means. It's the politicians and some members of the private sector. The country as a whole is remarkably tolerant and wants to accept Muslims as true mainstream citizens. So why not do this? The problem is that this has been tried. It works in crisis situations. If there's a riot coming up and you create these multi-ethnic groups, that has been shown to have some success in preventing riots. But moment the emergency is over, if you look at long-term development issues such as petitioning for political power and so on, that has disappeared as being effective. You create a Muslim civil society group or a Muslim political party, the problem is this. They're promptly deemed a security risk and are hounded, so they can't do this. The last one, which everyone tells me, ride the rising tide, wait it out and accept second-class status till then. The problem is ghettoization reduces gains. A failing or a very weak state like Pakistan today can give its Muslims about the same per capita income as the Muslims get in India, which is a travesty considering the high growth that India has had. So let me summarize. First, I try to show how identity, political power, and economic capacity are linked. The trigger for the downward spiral, I argued, was official disregard or manipulation of the laws, with the intention initially of degrading identity into a single dimension, and then that had spread-on effects. Ghettoization was the key channel for the downward spiral. However, despite the massive burden this has imposed on the community, it has looked after itself in social ways. You saw things like infant mortality rate, female survival rates, better even than the mainstream in ways that they could control, remained peaceful, unradicalized, and participative, and patriotic. But the options for positive change appear insignificant. My hypothesis, a virtuous spiral will require focus on official support for identity protection first. Okay, so I'm done. That's my presentation. Thank you. And, I stopped your question. Do you want to ask something now? You're okay. All right. Yes.
We have a microphone here for audience questions so that we can get that.
We can maybe just give him the mic. Or
sure, I can. We can pass the mic around. That we're a fairly small group. That might be.
Thank you. I may have missed
first?
Along the way a more.
Do you want them to announce their names first?
I may have missed along the way a longer. Backward look in the historical perspective. You started your earlier slide really started when the British left, but you alluded to the British, the 200 years. Go back several hundred years and walk forward the move of the Muslims in and when this started to come apart. Suggest it's accelerated more recently, but is that really true based on the historical
Yeah, life? That's a very good question. So I would say up till about 1857 when the British took direct rule of India. Before that, it was ruled by the East India Company. Muslims were probably above the socio-economic average, and the reason is that they had political power in many states. For example, Uttar Pradesh, parts of it, including Lucknow, were ruled by a Muslim dynasty. So given their political power and the fact that their language was being used for the business of state, the Muslims are actually very well off. So if you read, for example, a British writer, Hunter, in writing in 1871, he says the poorest Muslim is as well educated as the Prime Minister's son. He knows, he knows his Pythagoras as well as he knows his Aristotle. He has a full complement of Eastern education as well as Western education, except that it's all in Arabic. Now what happened was that in 1857 with the mutiny, the British essentially blamed the Muslims, because the mutiny originated in Muslim-ruled areas. And with that, they started a pattern of discrimination, or you can say divide and rule, in a way. It wasn't purely anti-Muslim, but they took the view that we should put in power locally people who are not of the same religion and create a religious difference. So if it was a Hindu area, they would deliberately choose a Muslim as the ruler, or their zamindar, or their landlord to collect taxes. And if there was a Muslim population, they would choose a Hindu. And they did. So by doing this, they first created the seeds of this identity as being only of your faith. Now, to an extent, that was there. So already by 1947, between 1857 and 1947, this discrimination had continued. And to a large extent, if at all it was against a particular community, it was against the Muslims. So already by 1947, that's why you saw that they had fallen somewhat below the average by then. But it wasn't of the crisis situation that it is today. So that's sort of a short wrap through history. Yes. Yeah. And then you can go ahead. We need the mic. Why don't you give it to me? I'll take it. And then you can pass it back.
I have two questions. One is, if on the one hand we're saying that the Muslims now or have been playing a decisive or strategic role in the
preventing the
choice
BJP.
Of mm-hmm. Who is going to win power, then how is it that they didn't get any advantage out of it?
Why haven't they been able to leverage that better?
Yeah.
It's a very good question. Why is it that Muslims voting strategically, like say the Communist Party of India in West Bengal, right? Strongly supported by the Muslims, because prior to the Marxists coming into power in West Bengal in 1968 with Ajoy Mukherjee and then 1970 with Jyoti Basu, prior to that, the Congress had a regular pattern of discriminating against Muslims. So the communists were viewed by them as a savior. just as they had been a savior for the Muslims in Kerala. But look what happened. You saw the employment numbers. 25% Muslim population in West Bengal, 2% employment in government. So M.G. Akbar, the famous columnist, writes a lot about this promise and betrayal. And he says it's a mixed reason. He says one is Muslims, once they're in power, have to do many things to survive. They can't just say we are Muslim, we are Muslim, we are Muslim. They want to be mainstreamed. Okay. And they're looking for opportunities, but the politicians haven't delivered. They have many priorities. And then when it comes election time again, they'll offer a few stops. Mamata Banerjee, just now elected to in West Bengal, does that. Just around election time, she'll declare, oh, you can, you know, this mosque will get this much money and so on. Get the money, then forget about that.
Okay, my second question was that is there any benefit in looking at Muslims separate, the South India and North India separately, because their route and the way they had evolved in India have been quite different?
Yes, I would say it depends which part of South. And if you look at Karnataka, which is South, there the Muslims mostly speak Urdu and sort of, in a sense, identify with the northern Indian.
And they had integrated much better and much earlier.
In Kerala and Tamil Nadu. So in two states in India, they are integrated.
So,
for those two states, actually, Muslims have done quite well.
Quite well, right.
Yes, they have done quite well.
So that's probably a lesson for the Muslims in the north.
What is the lesson?
They have to integrate, but they have to...
If you vote in every election... You petition the government peacefully. Is that not a measure of integration? What do you mean by saying that they are not integrating?
See, one area in which they lost out is the education. Because India is all about education. And for some reason, they have been lagging behind. Not because there is no facility, just that...
No, because there's no facility. If you read the Sachar Committee report, this is the first one that carefully documents that the government does not set up schools in Muslim areas. Where they set up schools, they don't send the teachers. There's active discrimination. And that is why. Otherwise, why would a community have so much better health parameters? Does that not show their participation? You see, they want to look after themselves. Pass it back, please. But these are common myths, you know, I understand.
Hi.
Hello.
I have two questions. One is, you mentioned India's activist Supreme Court.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit, please.
Okay. So the Supreme Court has taken its debt by the intellectually, explicitly revealed to me by a Chief Justice of the Justice Supreme Court quite recently. It's a debt to Earl Warren of the U.S. Supreme Court, right? The Warren Court 51 through 69 has decided that the public of India needs to be protected from government wherever necessary. So what their view is that very often politicians will make decisions that are not in the public interest. It's perfectly within the ambit of the Supreme Court to convert any issue they want on their own recognition, suo motu as it's called, into a public interest litigation. So, for example, recently a man was convicted in Kolkata, in West Bengal. He'd gone to a red light area and had battered one prostitute to death. So he was convicted. He appealed the conviction to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court not only upheld the conviction, but also on its own converted that into public interest litigation, even though there hadn't been anyone from the public. And as a result of that, made a decision that the government must now set up certain facilities and report back to the court on a regular basis on what they have done for sex workers around the country, certain facilities for education, for access to good health care, and so on. So that's an example of the activist Supreme Court. In the field of corruption, they've been especially activist in the last few years, which is why, to some extent, there's some action going on now about corruption. It looks like there isn't, because what's happening as a result of the court, all the corruption is coming out to light, which was hidden earlier. And so it appears that India is more corrupt, but it's not. It's always been very corrupt, but it's coming out now and these problems are getting tackled. Your second question?
Yes. As far as would you ever support non-peaceful means of resisting this oppression?
Oh, no, because that would make it even worse. If you're outnumbered 10 to 1 and the police is against you, and in principle, I don't support violence at all. But even if you thought of it not as a principle but as a strategy, it would fail.
But with the Arab Spring and a lot of the Middle East?
The Arab Spring is very different. You know, that's a non-democratic structure where a massive population, the majority, was denied rights. Here there's hope. It's a democracy. Your vote counts. You know, as I said, the majority of the population is anything but radicalized, and the majority of the population is Hindu. So there's hope if you can, if the government just gets this identity issue right. That's why I came up with this conclusion. I think it'll do wonders.
Thank you.
We have time for one more question. Well, I have a question.
Thank you. Dr. Dasani, I know you have written in the Chronicle about the Cairo demonstrations and so-called Arab Spring. Was there any reaction among the Muslim community in India? Any changes in their orientation?
I think they looked on it with great interest because here was a largely peaceful uprising that resulted in something hopefully of great benefit to the country, right? And I think the lessons, and I did talk about this in my visits in India last month, in interviews with various people, I said, what do you see as the potential for doing this through civil society? And again, you know, the answer was, I came up earlier, is they said, India is very different, you know. You wouldn't get mass support for such a thing. You know, even Muslims would hesitate because they would say, end of the day, if the government comes down on me heavily, I won't get supported by the rest of the population. Yeah, unfortunately.
Our thanks to our speaker, Dr. Rafiq Dasani, who is a senior research scholar at the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University, for his very illuminating talk here today. Thank you for coming, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.